Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, I'd like to thank you for tuning in this Tuesday evening to a very special broadcast. But first, some cursory announcements. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. That's 928-333-2942. And please be courteous on your messages, ladies and gentlemen. Right when you want to leave a message, please leave your name, contact number back to you, and the topic right off, or it will just get erased. Because the on-and-on biographies of the whole history of some alien spacecraft in Nevada, those messages are getting old, and all they do is tie up the machine from productive users. So, if I don't hear that information right off, it just will be erased. 928-333-2942. And my personal email, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now also the studio in Canada, if you'd prefer to call there, if you're one of the Canadian listeners, 613-733-4324. 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope, as usual, you have something to write with this evening, because you're going to want to take notes. This ties right in with the Strategic Hamlet program. I gave you the foundation of the concept of strategic hamlets, starting with military leadership from the United Kingdom in the 50s in Malaya, and our mimicking in the Philippines, and on into the Vietnam War. Now we're going to take you into a little lost history of Helmand, Afghanistan this evening. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, all the parallels are still there, all the same signs and programs, and you can see what a well-monopolized and planned and orchestrated event several of these are when you tie the history together. So after this musical break, be sure to be ready to take notes. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, thank you to Adam Curtis and, of course, Mr. Olfeld there for their help in the broadcast tonight. And I want to bring up a story that was very well done. I'm gathering several video links, etc., of historic footage. Actually, not gathering. Putting them in one place so that if you're interested, you can contact me. I already have several links available. They show some interesting original footage and aspects to support this broadcast, as well as other documentation, photographs, etc. Now, when you look, ladies and gentlemen, at the footage of the fighting in the Hellman today, most of you will assume it's being played out against an ancient background of villages and fields built over the centuries. This is not true, however. If you look beyond the soldiers and into the distance, what you are really seeing are the ruins of one of the biggest technological projects the United States has ever undertaken. Its aim? To use science to try and change the course of history and produce a modern utopia in Afghanistan. The city of Lashkargah was built by the Americans as a model planned city, and the hundreds of miles of canals that the Taliban now hide in were constructed by the same company that built the San Francisco Bay Bridge and Cape Canaveral. The story, ladies and gentlemen, of this long forgotten and strange project starts back with what many people have deemed the Holocaust, which had the unforeseen consequence of making Afghanistan very rich. The fur trade in Europe, which had been predominantly run by Jews there, was closed down. It moved to New York, where there was a growing demand for Astrakhan coats made with the fur of fat-tailed sheep from Afghanistan. We have photos gathered, ladies and gentlemen, of ads during the period showing how proud they were of their product and their sheep. Well, as a result, ladies and gentlemen, dollars poured into Afghanistan, and by 1946, the country had 100 million in reserve. The king, Zahir Shah, decided to spend the money on a dam. His aim was to create a modern state, and with it spread the power of the Pashtun tribes. So, he hired the giant American firm Morrison Knudsen, who had built the Hoover Dam in the 1930s, and they began surveying Afghanistan's biggest river, the Helmand. If you go back, you can even find from the Morrison Knudsen magazine expressions of the ambition scale of the project, calling it Little America in Afghanistan. Now, Nick Kuhlether from Indiana University needs to be thanked for finding this documentation, pictures, original books, etc. Then, in the early 1950s, ladies and gentlemen, one of the MK engineers, called Paul Jones, wrote a book about his time in Helmand. He called it Afghanistan Venture. You can see from this following excerpt, ladies and gentlemen, in the book, the idea, the idealism of the Americans involved, and possibly of the Afghans, too. Quote, "Yes, all about is life and an air of hopeful expectancy. In the beginning, we Americans, each in our own humble way, fervently pray of a new Afghanistan rising out of the mysteries of forgotten centuries to become truly a modern star of Asia." Here, before the eyes of John, Muhammad, and myself in this vast desert expanse on a February afternoon, lay remnants of an ancient, powerful civilization. And over there is the beginning of a new civilization, a new way of life, abounding in the riches of worthy endeavor. And look, what is the cause of those rolling dust clouds, obliterating much landscape to the northwest? An approaching sandstorm? No, it is the MKA cat spread. Caterpillar tractors, bulldozers, 25 cubic yard carryalls, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, you get the hint there. But almost immediately, things started to go wrong. In 1949, the first small diversion dam was built. However, it raised the level of the water table in the whole area, and that brought salt to the surface. The American engineers realized this meant that the whole project probably wouldn't work. But at that very moment, President Truman made a speech promising to give aid to poor countries. It was the start of the Cold War, and Truman was going to use development projects and American money to stop countries from becoming communist. The Americans liked dams. They were a way of challenging the communists because they would create more fertile land, so people could be better off without having to redistribute land through a revolution. In 1952, the Helmand Valley Authority was set up. It was modeled on the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, created by Roosevelt in the 1930s. Faced with this engineer's doubts about the project, were buried and forgotten. Massive loans poured in from America and two giant dams were built, plus 300 miles of very large canals. But more problems emerged. Everything became waterlogged, which then led to weeds. Salt kept on suddenly appearing. And the reservoirs and the canals made the water cooler, which meant that there couldn't be any vineyards and orchards any longer. In futures, they could only grow grain. But again, all the doubts and worries were overwhelmed because the American technocrats and politicians had become fascinated by a new idea. It was called modernization theory. That's modernization theory. It said that there was a way of using science and technology not just to stop countries like Afghanistan going communist, but to actually transform them into democratic capitalist societies like America. Modernization theory had been invented by an ambitious academic at Harvard called Walt Whitman Rostow. He said that if you put the right technologies in place and educated key elites, then the country would inevitably develop into advanced capitalist societies. They would go through a series of logical stages, there were five, until you got where he modestly called Rostovian liftoff. Rostow laid out his theory in a book, ladies and gentlemen, that he called The Stages of Economic Growth, a Non-Communist Manifesto. Again, Rostow, The Stages of Economic Growth, a Non-Communist Manifesto. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Rostow's theories obsessed the American development agencies. And they came up with all sorts of ideas about how to turn countries like Afghanistan into modern democracies. One of the oddest was the belief that it was possible to scientifically discover who the crucial, quote, transitional personalities, end quote, were in society. Ladies and gentlemen, transitional personalities. These were people who had underlying capitalist personalities that they were unaware of. A psychologist called David McClelland invented a way of discovering who had these traits and techniques to then develop what he called the need to achieve. He was convinced you could use behavioral psychology to turn people throughout the world into modern model Americans. I have some clips, ladies and gentlemen, as an aside, from a public information film about McClelland and his beliefs of how you could change the course of history by using his modern scientific methods. McClelland worked tirelessly to prove his case. One of his diagrams showed that the frequency of achieving imagery in children's books in the late 19th century leads inevitably to a rise in inventions in America as they grow up, correlated with the number of patented inventions in his chart. Well, ladies and gentlemen, leave it to the technocrats, the bureaucrats, and the thought police. And one of the theories of Rostow and McClelland, when they joined, came a wave of educational and behavioral psychology projects to transform the Afghans into modern, motivated human beings. The Afghan government and the American agencies produced books full of photographs that showed these modernized beings in their new, modernized world. Scenes of people broadcasting in engineering studios, happily waiting in line at post offices, at the library, in the newest, most stylish American dresses, looking through the most modern of magazines. Well, for the Americans, the heroic figure in all this was the engineer. Millions and millions were poured into building a brand new engineering department at Kabul University. But there was one transitional personality that the Americans were worried about. He was the Prime Minister Mohammed Daoud. He was also the king's brother-in-law and cousin. Daoud was a Pashtun, and he wanted the Pashtuns to have permanent control over Afghanistan. He was a ruthless politician and spent his time playing the countries who wanted to give him aid against each other. There are plenty of photographs, ladies and gentlemen, of Daoud in the company of Eisenhower, Khrushchev, Chiang Kai-shek, and other powerful people. So, upon that realization, the Americans decided to give Prime Minister Daoud the thing he dreamed of. They would turn Helmand Province into a settled Pashtun area, which would consolidate the Pashtuns' powerful grip on the whole country. It was, to say the least, an extraordinary project. The Americans set out to take thousands of families of Pashtun nomads who spent their time roaming the border area with Pakistan and settle them in small holdings in Helmand. This would be turned into sedentary farmers. It was a giant piece of social engineering. Even Swiss experts were flown in to teach the Pashtuns how to use long-handled scissors to cut grass for their sheep. The Americans liked it because it would take a lawless group of nomads who were always straying over the border into Pakistan and starting local wars and turn them into peaceful farmers. Prime Minister Daoud liked it because it was an opportunity to increase Pashtun power, sometimes in not very nice ways. One of his political critics put it bluntly, quote, he wanted to use these new settlers as a death squad to crush the uprising of non-Pushtun people on the southwest and central part of the country, end quote. Out of this came not just new homesteads, but a giant modern infrastructure. At its center was the modern planned city of Lashkar Gah. As many of the engineers working there described it, like an American suburb. A model world that would help transform the warlike and unruly tribes people into democratic and achieving citizens. You can still see today photographs taken by, for instance, Michael Yon, showing Lashkar Gah to this day. And you can see in those photos remnants that look exactly like an American suburb of the 1950s. And it was at this very moment that a world-famous historian called Arnold Toynbee visited Helmand. Toynbee had spent his life studying the giant sweep of history to find out what made different civilizations rise and fall. Toynbee drove from Kandahar to Lashkar Gah past all the giant canals and dams. He was shocked. What he was seeing, he said, was not a new civilization, but a piece of America inserted into the Afghan landscape. The new world they are conjuring up at the Helmand River's expanse is to be an America in Asia. Let me give that quote again. A piece of America inserted into the Afghan landscape. The new world they are conjuring up at the Helmand River's expanse is to be an America in Asia. End quote. Think back, ladies and gentlemen, to the MK engineers and the Star of Asia. Toynbee quoted Sophocles' warning. The craft of his engines surpasses his dreams. What he meant there, ladies and gentlemen, was that you couldn't change history with just machines and science. Toynbee believed that what led to civilization's rise and fall was culture and religion. A year after he returned, Toynbee gave a series of lectures called America and World Revolution, which was published as a book. Ladies and gentlemen, I highly suggest you seek out that book, America and World Revolution. In 1962, Toynbee, in an interview with the BBC, warned of the neglect of religion and religious values in this rush to modernity. It was the beginning of the conservative reaction to the techno-utopian dreams of progress of the 50s and 60s. What is fascinating, ladies and gentlemen, in his argument, if you think about it, was that religion was the only real force in the West that can give meaning and purpose in life. It is exactly, by the way, the same as the new political Islamist ideals that were beginning to emerge on the campuses of Cairo, Kabul, and Islamabad. Toynbee was an atheist. But he believed that without such meaning, social structures in Western society will corrode. It is the same conservative argument, by the way, that you'll find in the writings of Sayyid Qutb in Egypt and Mawadudi in Pakistan. But the king of Afghanistan loved the American modernization project. And he now set out to transform not just the urban elite, but every Afghan into transitional beings. And to do this, he was going to get rid of the burqa. One of the most perceptive observers of that period in Kabul was the American archaeologist Louis Dupree. He will become central in this whole story, ladies and gentlemen. He had just arrived in Kabul, and he wrote a letter describing the model the king had approved for women during the transition period. Quote, "All the women wear the costume accepted for the transitional period. No facial makeup, dark sunglasses, headscarf, a duster or a raincoat or a dress tailored to resemble a coat, and gloves. Some wear the dark glasses indoors and others do not." End quote. The project was the main talking point at a party at the U.S. Embassy, and a group of American women in Kabul decided to help push the king's transitional aims even further. They were the wives of the American executives who ran the Afghan national airline, Ariana. Even the airline was part of the development project, and it was owned and run by Pan American Airlines from San Francisco. The wives decided they would put on a fashion show to demonstrate to the Afghan women how to be truly modern. Pan Am in the U.S. thought it was such a good idea, they even approached Vogue magazine to help. There is a press release from Pan Am Public Relations that tells what happened. More than a third of the women in Kabul, Afghanistan, are now wearing modern dress due to the enterprise and energy of one American woman. The American woman, Mrs. Jeanne Beecher, who returned this week after 3 years in Kabul, Afghanistan, is the wife of Ralph Beecher, assistant to the vice president and general manager of Ariana Airlines Company. It was she who sensed the desire of Native women to wear Western dress and prevailed upon Pan American World Airways to send sewing aids and patterns to make possible a school of dressmaking as part of Pan Am's activities under the Technical Assistance Program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the same program that fueled every communist country that then killed American GIs. Vogue Pattern Service responded to a Pan American request and donated 200 patterns from which the clothes were made. The dressmaking school was started in Kabul under the auspice of the Women's Welfare Society, sponsored by the royal family and other prominent persons. It was staffed by a group of 8 American women, most of them wives of Pan Am employees, who served as voluntary teachers under the leadership of Mrs. Beecher. In the fall of 1959, about 32 Afghan women participated in the program. They met in classes of 8 under the guidance of 2 American instructors and worked for an hour and a half each week for several months. All the women in these classes had been in the purdah until then, wearing veils. They represented the upper middle and middle class, reflecting a great variety of culture and educational backgrounds. By last June, 15 women were ready to model the clothes they had made in the dressmaking school. They were made from native or imported fabrics and had been cut under the supervision of the American teachers, but sewn in their own homes on hand-powered sewing machines. Since then, another supply of Vogue patterns has been donated, and Pan Am sent additional sewing aids, such as zippers, threads, cutting boards, and scissors. Shortly before Mrs. Beecher left Afghanistan, another fashion show was given, demonstrating the tremendous strides that have been made by Afghan women, not only in their clothes, but in new habits of personal hygiene, makeup, and grooming. End of letter, ladies and gentlemen, or press release, I should say. If you want to look up all of Pan American Airways Incorporated records, they're held at the University of Miami's Special Collection Department. You can see by looking at various Vogue patterns of the day, sewing patterns, that is, from the 60s, what the airline wives hope Afghan women would become. There are assuredly both photos and film of the fashion show, and Mr. Curtis himself has been looking feverishly for some photos to help in this documentation. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go to a quick musical break. Sorry for that slight interruption. There seems to be someone at the studio doors, so let me get to them real quick and I'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, again, you're listening to your host here, Doyle Shamley, on The Hour of the Time, with the lost history of Helmand, Afghanistan. Think back, ladies and gentlemen, onto the projects of the strategic hamlets and the psychological operations that were conducted surrounding them, and the social experimentation starting with the United Kingdom military forces and American forces in the Philippines and Malaya, on into and through Vietnam, and pay close attention where this started and where this is going in Afghanistan. And again, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. The studio number here in Arizona, 928-333-2942. And in Canada, if you prefer or live up there, 613-733-4324. My personal email, ladies and gentlemen, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, all of this vast dream of a modern world, and with it, the king's power was entirely based on the success of the development projects. Above all, the Helmand Dam and irrigation scheme. The trouble was that they were not a success in any way or form. In reality, Helmand was a disaster. There was so much water in the ground in some areas that houses and mosques were crumbling into a growing bog. Even worse, underneath the new man-made oasis, the engineers had discovered hard rock, which made them even more waterlogged. So they had to dig deep bore drains, which removed 10% of the area from cultivation. Then a study showed that crop yields were steadily falling. But the academics advising the American development agencies had a new theory that explained this. It was called dual economic theory. It said that you not only had to modernize the infrastructure, you also had to bring agriculture up to date. So the American planners turned to the most up-to-date theory. It was called the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution, ladies and gentlemen, as opposed to the Red Revolution the Russians were exporting at the time. This new theory was based on the new type of high-yield wheat that had been developed by a scientist named Norman Borlaug. And the development agencies brought in 170 tons of the experimental dwarf wheat developed by Borlaug in Mexico. But by now, many of the nomads had settled and divided the land into Helmand into small plots. The problem was that to make the Green Revolution work and the wheat grow effectively, the area would have to be turned back into vast open spaces. In other words, the whole settlement system would have to be put in reverse. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, the Green Revolution calls for a complete reversal of settled, modernized, efficient areas. Undeterred, as today you see in many agendas, the U.S. Department of Agriculture proposed that the Helmand Valley Authority remove all the settlers. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to go back and listen to several of the audio series I've done on the Wildlands Project, the Biosphere Treaties, the Kyoto Treaties, Bios and Bioregional Government, and who are they promulgated by today? That's right, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And what do they propose today, ladies and gentlemen? Removing the settlers of the land. Now, in the case of the Helmand Valley Authority, under the guidance and propositions of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, once they removed all the settlers, then they would level the whole area with bulldozers and redistribute the property in large, uniform, smooth land plots. That's a quote, ladies and gentlemen, from the reports. Level the whole area with bulldozers and redistribute the property in large, uniform, smooth land plots. Ladies and gentlemen, are you not seeing that right now under the guise of bailout? Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Within many of our cities, instead of bringing back industry and getting rid of illegal taxation, oppressive taxation that stifles free enterprise and progress and profit and employs people, the government has come about with schemes of bailouts. And much of those bailouts, ladies and gentlemen, center around converting settled urban areas and suburban areas both from the guise of manufacturing facilities and neighborhoods to nice flat level plots of land so we can all enjoy and hold hands and sing Kumbaya together in a park that we paid 10 times more than what it's worth. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the Hellman Valley authorities' grand scheme here, after they bulldozed all these large settlements and then redistributed the property into uniform, smooth land plots, then they're going to cut down all the trees that we've spent a decade growing. But guess what, ladies and gentlemen? When it was tried, the bulldozers and the American technocrats were confronted by the Pashtun farmers with rifles. They refused to allow their new homes to be destroyed. USAID reported back to Washington, and that's the agency, ladies and gentlemen, that I've covered at great lengths on the broadcast in the past and in written articles. USAID reported back to Washington, "This presents a very real constraint on the project," end quote. Much of all this, ladies and gentlemen, remember, had been inspired by the ideas of the American academic Walt Rostow. By now, Rostow had become one of the most powerful men in America, special advisor for national security. And he was developing these ideas even further in another country, Vietnam. By 1965, the Americans were fighting a bitter guerrilla war against an unseen enemy, the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong hid among the thousands of villages in South Vietnam from which they attacked the Americans. Rostow was convinced that you could use modernization theory to transform the country and defeat the communists. Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? What ideal Rostow was a supporter of? Strategic hamlets. And to him, the theory was very simple. You took all the quote-unquote good Vietnamese out of the villages and resettled them in new planned villages, which could be protected by the Americans. There, the villagers would be educated by psychologists and special cadres to become new modern civilizations and citizens devoted to democracy. Ladies and gentlemen, in 1965, there was a short film by BBC which showed the system that the Americans had created in Vietnam and all its weirdness, quite honestly. And by now, it had become the central strategy in the counterinsurgency. Then in 1969, the Afghan government and the American planners finally promised the year of yield takeoff. But there was a drought. The Helmand River became a trickle. The main reservoir created by the project dried up completely. Wheat yields were the lowest in the world, 4 bushels to an acre. Iowa's yield was 180 bushels to the acre. This created a massive food crisis, which began to destabilize the government and the king. There were student strikes. Many of the student leaders came from the engineering department, which was now full of communist and Maoist cells. Then, one of the communist students defected to a new group of revolutionaries, the Islamists. He was called Guldabin Hekmarder, and he became notorious for his violence. Some say he went round throwing acid in the faces of women without headscarves. But he denies this and says that if he lived in the West, he would sue for libel. He was given the nickname, the Engineer. In 1972, the Parliament was suspended, excuse me, and a year later, the Prime Minister Dow joined with the army to mount a coup that got rid of the king. Ladies and gentlemen, did you listen to my previous broadcast about the president of South Vietnam? It was, ladies and gentlemen, the beginning of the chaos that would lead the country into anarchy and disaster, and the end of the dreams of the Helmand Valley Project. The Americans began to leave, abandoning a vast infrastructure that started to decay. But during the Soviet War, both sides found a use for the remains of the project. Again, ladies and gentlemen, American blood and money helping the Soviets. The giant reservoir was used to dump bodies tortured and killed by the Khalkh communist. Why the Mujahideen used the water channels for cover when fighting the Russians. And the new soil was very suitable for a new crop, the opium poppy. It grows well in dry climates and in alkaline and saline soils, and poppy growing increased massively in Helmand in the 1980s, and with it, the heroin trade. Then, in 1994, the Taliban movement began in Helmand province as an alliance of Pashtun clans. While in power, the Taliban government finished a central part of the Helmand Valley Project that the Americans had left unfinished in the 70s. It was a hydroelectric plant that would use Kajaki Dam to bring electricity to the city of Kandahar. The Taliban finally finished it in early 2001. Then, later that year, American B-52s bombed the plant. And ladies and gentlemen, there are BBC News archives of the American attack on the dam of November 2001. But guess what? That wasn't the end. In 2007, British troops found themselves fighting the Taliban amongst the ruins of the American Dam Project. Ladies and gentlemen, then in 2008, a convoy battled through Taliban attacks to bring, guess what, a new turbine to the dam. In 2007, ladies and gentlemen, British troops found themselves fighting the Taliban amongst the ruins of the American Dam Project. Then in 2008, a convoy battled its way through the Taliban attacks to bring a new turbine to the dam. The aim, the British said, was to start a development project which would finally help Afghanistan become a modern country. Well, yes, ladies and gentlemen, again, I'm glad you tuned in this evening for the Hour of the Time, and I hope you took the studious notes, and you can see the historical ties here throughout American intervention projects and State Department foreign policy as written by communists, ladies and gentlemen. And let us not forget what Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't forget that the Hour of the Time is listener-supported, and if you want to continue to hear cutting-edge research from the Hour of the Time and have chat rooms available and cutting-edge Veritas news exclusives on the website and expanded archives converted to digital formats and audio and video series is released, of which we're about to do a ton of them, I can see in the next 2 weeks or so, then you need to remember that we are listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get this word out about the history out there around us that's been forgotten, where it ultimately leads people when they forget. And let's get out the facts and truth of freedom, not the fear-mongering or the scare tactics or the sky is falling, a company with overpriced gold, garden seeds, and miracle cures. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for you to step up to the plate and do your part. Thank you, Mr. Curtis, for the wonderful research. Rob, for posting this and keeping all things in order on that end. And thank you, DK, for this wonderful music, so fitting. And again, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Hour of the Time.